Lecture 7, Aristotle on Justice and Politics.
The contribution that Aristotle makes toward natural law theory in the course of his moral and political writings is enormously indebted to that very flexible and dynamic notion of his nature that we were discussing in the last lecture. Namely, by envisioning human nature as being like all the other natures of things in the world, as having a certain dynamism that is already found in a being at the very beginning of its existence, a dynamism toward the complete flowering of the full form of human nature, Aristotle can account for a tremendous variety of the various parts of our moral and political and social lives. What I'd like to do in this particular lecture is to use some of the concepts that we were discussing in Aristotle's Metaphysics in the last lecture and use them by considering two of his writings on the subject of ethics and politics, namely his book, The Nicomachean Ethics, in which he elaborates personal morality in social context, and then his work, The Politics, in which he is envisioning the state and the society in which we live as part of the natural outflowing, as part of the flowering of our human nature. And we'll be making extensive use of this concept of nature, as well as of the notions of potency and act, which are crucial to his understanding of absolutely anything. Now, Aristotle is not, strictly speaking, a natural law theorist, and I need to make that clear here at the beginning, because in the retelling of this history, it is a history that itself has tremendous progress at certain points, and then needs to stop and reflect and gather its forces. Aristotle, I do not think of as, strictly speaking, a natural law thinker, largely because he does not articulate his ethics in terms of law. That will require the Stoics, whom we will consider in a subsequent lecture. But he is very much a natural virtue theorist, and the central concept of his ethics is this notion of virtue articulated in terms of nature. Let's do a moment to just review his general sense of what virtue is and then start to use the language of nature in order to see his deeper explanation of the subject. Aristotle gives in the Nicomachean Ethics, books 2, 3, 4, and 5, an account of the various virtues. And he thinks about human virtue as being a matter of a human habit which is well reinforced, a habit which is developed out of practice, but more and more chosen, so that we can operate on the basis of this habit in a way that is easy and efficient and with a certain pleasure. Now, the various habits that are involved in the course of our moral life are for him primarily four. There is first a habit of prudence, that is, the ability to see a situation realistically, the way it is, and an ability to deliberate upon our options and alternatives, so that in a certain reasonable period of time, we come to make a good choice about the matter. Secondly, there is the topic of courage. This is the matter of dealing with our emotions, dealing with our feelings, particularly our feeling of bravado in the face of danger, or equally our feeling of fear. And he thinks of courage as that habit of responding to fear and to excitement in a way that is reasonable, neither cowardly nor excessively rash. Third, he thinks of the virtue of temperance, that virtue that is the habit of choosing well with respect to the fulfilling of our desires. It might be the desire for food, the desire for drink, the desire for company, the desire for sexual intercourse, any of the things which are bodily desires. We can desire them in the right way so that we will get the fruition of what it is we desire, but we will not either become a slave to those desires or, on the other hand, we will not become insensitive to those desires. Finally, he thinks of the virtue of justice. And in the case of justice, it's a matter of getting what is fair, getting what is due, and learning how both to give and to take with respect to those quantities, neither giving away excessively nor taking excessively, not being inclined to hold everything in the mode of a miser, nor, on the other hand, being someone who is very superfluous with his money. Now, in all of these virtues, Aristotle discerns a central and common structure, and it's the structure of excellence, which he envisions as a kind of a peak, an excellence of response, neither excessive nor deficient. But he regards these virtues, that is, the habit, the tendency, the reliable disposition to make the right response in a given situation, he regards these virtues as a kind of second nature. And when he calls them our second nature, he is obviously contrasting this state of development, this state of excellence, when we have accustomed ourselves and habituated ourselves to responding in ways that are right for the circumstances. He calls these second nature in contrast with first nature. That is, our first nature, much as we were describing it in the previous lecture, our first nature is what we're born with. Our first nature refers to our bodily structure and to the activities that are typical of us. So, the animal activities that we have to preserve our lives by taking in nutrition, by receiving the right amount of stimulation and activity, by taking the right amount of rest and repose, sleep, and other kinds of refreshment. But in addition to these basically animal activities, all the other sorts of higher activities, our senses, so that each of our powers of sensation, our sight and our hearing, our taste, our touch, our smell, our powers of locomotion, our ability to walk around and to move and to use our bodies, each of these natural powers also has a certain natural or primary disposition, the way we find ourselves, in the way that sometimes people find themselves throwing balls well, or perhaps not so well and in need of much training, or people who speak well, or people, on the other hand, who need some training in speech, that we find a certain natural disposition, the way we just come, and then by virtue of careful parental training, by virtue of our own choices, by virtue of the kind of reinforcement and further discipline that comes with schools, that comes with sports teams, that comes with habits of association when we're with others and they egg us on to do better, we can take any one of these natural physical abilities and the tendency that we have to operate and to act in a certain way, and we can make it better by habituating ourselves, seeking out real excellence, and learning the techniques for improving our natural operation. Aristotle considers both on the natural level of physical activities and on the natural level of our intellectual activities, our patterns of knowing, our patterns of understanding, our patterns of knowing how to do things in the way of the arts, and as well as our patterns of knowing how to understand things in the various sciences, that in any of these spheres, we take a certain natural ability and we can hone it to that point of excellence so that we will someday have second nature or virtue. Now, in so calling it, Aristotle is, I think, making a very interesting and sophisticated distinction, namely, that these points of excellence, even though they are developments of what we find given in us, are still natural. They are natural in the sense that he had been describing things that have a nature or are natural, namely, that whatever the thing starts with, whatever basic structure is found in its genetic code, whatever structures and operations are typical of it, simply on the basis of the matter and form combination that forms the basis and the substance of anything, also embedded in that initial nature is final nature. That is, also embedded in that initial organization is an end or a goal, the goal of being a full, mature instance of the species, but also the goal of acting well according to that species. Hence, these excellences that we develop by our repeated exercises so that we develop a habit and a second nature, so that we're really good about the use of our bodies, or really good about the use of our minds, or really good about the kind of choices we make, all of these things are natural to us in the sense that they are realizations. They are ways in which we can actualize the native potencies that we have. As such, there could be a tremendous, almost an infinite number of these possibilities for virtue. But Aristotle further discerns in the course of his study that there are certain virtues which are extremely important. And that set of four that I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture, prudence, courage, temperance, and justice, are given a sort of privileged standing by him, because when he surveys both his own Greek culture and the various other cultures that he comes in contact with, he can see that these are points of excellence, that these are aspects of human living and living well that will be necessary for any kind of living in society, for any sort of social living. Consider each of them in turn and how they contribute toward the natural flourishing, toward the natural fulfillment of what it is that the possibilities for human nature originally entail. In the case of prudence, it's a matter of seeing a situation realistically. Whether we've ever developed the habit of prudence, we do spend so much of our time trying to figure out what the situation is. But we've got a real habit there, a real virtuous habit, if we are able to make the distinctions between what appears to be friendliness, but is really just flattery, and what is real friendliness, a person who's really willing to look out for our good or are willing to look out for their good. And that prudential discernment between mere appearance and the genuine stuff is a crucial virtue to have if one is to succeed. Likewise, in the case of courage, there are people who are very spontaneously and natively rash. They're bold. They're ready to face any danger. But real courage, as we know, sometimes requires hanging back and waiting until the appropriate moment. It's not simply a boldness in the face of any danger, but it's a prudent boldness, a boldness that responds in the right way, at the right time, under the circumstances as they are. Similarly, in the case of temperance, we have to know much about our own bodies and what pleasures we're attracted to and how we deal with pleasures as they come. If it be the pleasure of drink, for instance, that we have to know how much it is that we can use in order to achieve the pleasure of drink, and what would be excessive, what will feel real good, but in fact will lead us to lose consciousness and to lose control and to be in some way or other intemperate and out of control so that we're unable to make other good choices. And of course, in the sphere of justice, in dealing with all the goods and services and the various kinds of exchanges that we make with one another in the course of living together in society, justice will be that habit of seeking excellence at giving and taking, absolutely indispensable for social living. Justice will be a matter of the habit of doing this rightly, neither giving away everything we have, appearing generous but now impoverishing ourselves, and the mean or the point of excellence between that, and on the other hand, being too greedy, being too inclined to take everything for ourselves, finding ways to manipulate the situation. But rather, real justice will be this excellence at finding what is proper and fair and what is truly due for the other. In Aristotle's account of all of this, we see the virtues in each of these cases, prudence, courage, temperance, and justice, as being real contributory factors, really important constituents of what it is that makes for human flourishing. Now, in the effort to identify these, Aristotle, in the Nicomachean Ethics, very early on, associates each of these with nature and with natural function. This is a part of his argument that is extremely important to natural law theory, and so I'd like to spend a little time on it before I move on to the rest of the consideration of his political theory. It is basically this. He starts with the same kind of example that he started with when, in the last lecture, we were considering his analysis of the four causes. When we were doing that, we used an artificial example first, a bronze sculpture. And we were suggesting that in that artificial example, we had bronze, which got put into a certain form, by a sculptor from the outside for an end that was in the sculptor's mind. Likewise here, he starts with an artificial example, a tool. You might take, for instance, a hammer, or you could take an instrument like a piano. And he notes that tools are designed by their maker to have a certain goal, to do a certain thing well, that hammers are designed for pounding nails, that pianos are designed for playing beautiful music. They can be used for other purposes. I could use hammers for trying to put screws into walls, but hammers won't do well with that because they don't take advantage of what is native to the design of a screw. In the course of analyzing artificial objects and noticing the particular function for which the structure is so well designed, it's easy to see how this works with artificial objects. But then he starts his review of natural objects, and he takes note of plants, for instance. And plants are designed for the continuity of the species. All the seeds that any plant produces are there for the sake of the continuity of that plant species. And the other things that take place in a plant, it's growing, it's spreading out its leaves, it's phototropism turning a bit toward the sun, it's roots that ranch out into the soil in order to get moisture or to get minerals. Everything seems to be designed and put together so that the seeds will develop and ensure the continuity of the plant species. The plants don't particularly take care of their offspring, but everything about their own structure is designed for this natural end. Now, when we move the situation, move the analysis up to the next level, and look at animals, we see that all animal species have a same basic program. They, too, are designed for the continuity of their species, and Aristotle notes that animal species responding to the challenges of their environment can do so well because of their design. If the environment overwhelms them, they will not survive, but they're designed to meet the normal challenges of the environment. And yet, look at the added factor. All the taking in of nutrition, all the activities and the growth, all of the various operations that they perform are designed not only for the continuity of the species in the sense of the generation of offspring, but increasingly with more and more complicated animal species, the offspring need not only to be produced, but they need to be reared. There needs to be a certain training. Even little birds in the nest cannot fly right at the beginning, but need good, tender, loving care until eventually they're pushed out of their nest on their own to begin flying, and so too with other species. When Aristotle turns to the human species, he cannot help but notice the continuity as well as the difference, namely a strong sense that the human species is designed so that there will be a continuity of the species, that human procreation will develop offspring. And like the rest of the animals, these offspring will need care. In fact, need considerably more care than normal animal species need. And yet everything is designed about them, not only to generate the offspring, not only to provide for their initial rearing, but all the patterns of love and affection and of social bonds that are within us reinforce the tenderness and the good feeling, at least in the normal case, that will generate offspring and will see them reared and see them educated, because individuals of our human species need not only the kind of rearing and the kind of education and the kind of formation that is example, but also the kind of education and the kind of formation that is cultural, the providing through language of a sense of our tradition and of our history, a sense of what our family is and a sense of what our city is and a sense of what our state or our nation might be. That all of these things take place precisely by the proper use of the function, the abilities, the structures that are proper to us. Now, in Aristotle's analysis, this occurs in Book 1, Chapter 7 of the Nicomachean Ethics, what that proper function of humankind by its nature is rationality. Namely, our powers of knowing, as I described them in this last lecture, and our powers of choosing, especially as I was speaking of them in the beginning part of this lecture, talking about those various kinds of virtues. Our rationality for Aristotle, and anyone in the Aristotelian tradition, always has to be understood in terms of knowing and choosing. And it's a matter of being a proper function, proper in the sense of distinctive of the human species. That is, it's a greater power, a more developed power, in fact, a different kind of power than present anywhere else in the animal kingdom. It's a power that is proper to our kind, our rationality. What we can know so far exceeds the intelligence of even the most intelligent of animals. And our ability to choose so far exceeds any spontaneity, any freedom of movement that they exhibit. Aristotle contends that this concentration on the power of rationality as our proper function shows us the basic dimensions, the basic outlines of our ethics and politics. Namely, that our own life as individuals and our communal life as political organizations, as societies, as states, all needs to be designed in order to make good use of these natural powers and to assist others in their use. Hence, Aristotle's strong concentration on virtue. We have these powers natively. Invariably, we will use them and start to develop them in some way. But if we really want to flourish as individuals, and if we want our community to flourish, this is the place where we must spend our time in developing the habits and engaged in deliberate human training. Now, in his two books that I mentioned, The Nicomachean Ethics and The Politics, Aristotle takes this natural base and uses it as the foundation for developing a morality. In his account of ethics, individual ethics, in the Nicomachean Ethics, one has a long section on the names of these virtues, the descriptions that I gave of them as accounts of what second nature in its very best sense will be, and they culminate in the virtue of justice. The virtue of justice, as he understands the matter, is always rooted in natural justice, that is, rooted in our own sense of what is fair and what is due. This can be encoded in legal justice, and so you find within the fifth book of the Nicomachean Ethics some account of law, but the kind of law that he is thinking of is largely the law of human devising, the kind of laws that go into the constitution of any of the Greek city-states. And then in addition to the constitutions that they make, the various forms of legislation that their various councils and elected bodies, that their kings and that their various rulers devise for the sake of social order. He's not a natural law thinker in any explicit sense. That will wait for the Stoics and for subsequent Aristotelians. But he does articulate a notion of a natural justice that has to stand behind any form of law. And in this respect, he makes a tremendous contribution toward what is eventually going to be natural law theory. By natural justice, invariably he means this sense of what is due or what is fair. And it is his great hope, it's a hope that I think he shares with Plato and with Socrates, and in sharing it with them, he stands in considerable opposition to the Sophists who were so skeptical about the matter. It is his fond hope and his reasoned conviction that most communities do manage to do this well. And so Aristotle has a strong respect for the law that given communities have devised. But he always tempers that respect with a sense that laws as they are made by human beings need to reflect real justice, this sense of real fairness. Sometimes in the course of the history of natural law, one will find strong relativist objections, objections such as the Sophists made. But I find that even in the present day, when one finds a relativist in theory, there are very, very few relativists in practice. I'd like to tease with my students that some of them take a strongly relativist position when they are trying to argue for a position in ethics, but somehow when their grading comes, they don't like the grading to be relativist. They want to get exactly what it was that was fair and that it was due. I think that sort of insight, that even when one doesn't want to accept that there is such a thing as a natural justice, or that which is really true and really fair and really due, even when one doesn't want to accept that in theory, we have a spontaneous natural inclination to want to be treated fairly. And it's that insight that Aristotle records when he's arguing in favor of natural justice as the standard by which one tests the laws that get made and tries to see how each of them embodies this sense of fairness and justice in practice. At the same time, there is a good reminder and a healthy reminder that we find for natural law in general when we look at the texts of Aristotle. Just as we noted early on in this lecture series, the articulation of natural law theory is always done in the midst of a culture. It's always done in the midst of assumptions of a social nature. And often we can be blind to some of the limitations that our culture exhibits. So too with Aristotle, that even though he has such a strong sense of natural justice, such a strong sense that there is an ideal of fairness and equality and rightness that must stand behind any law, Aristotle doesn't question an existence of slaves in his society. That he is, in fact, he even tends to justify the notion of slaves on the basis of nature, suggesting that our analysis of the various kinds of human beings that we meet in the course of life, it doesn't for him suggest that everyone's equal. That's going to be a theory that we'll see in the next lecture when we meet the Stoics, and we'll see that developed in much greater measure later on in this course. But for Aristotle, his observation of humankind suggested to him a natural inequality. That is, there were some people who were really capable of virtue in the highest degree, others who were capable of independent living, and a large group that he thought were not capable even of independent living. Hence he proposes, not only in the Ethics, but especially at some length in the Politics, he even proposes that there are such things as natural slaves. It's a bit embarrassing to some later Aristotelians who have an egalitarian presumption that they bring to the text. I'm not going to try to defend him on that, but I would at least like to explain what it is that he's maintaining there, because it's a question that is often asked of Aristotle and his ethics and his politics. Namely, that his approach to the matter does not assume that everyone's, for example, a child of God. He doesn't presume that there's a basic equality, but rather, using the best that he can do by way of reflection upon what he's observed, he would argue that there is a natural inequality, and hence that natural inequality has to be accepted, has to be articulated, has to be granted if that's the way things are. But he argues that this is not for the sake of domination, that this is not for the sake of power. He urges that this is actually for the good of those individuals who are inferior. His idea here seems to be that a person who cannot control himself, a person who is given over to pleasures, a person who cannot make a prudent judgment about how he should conduct himself so as to get anywhere in the world, or a person who cannot even get through the day because he's constantly distracted, because he is unable to make good decisions. Aristotle thinks that that person ought to be under the control of someone who can look out for them. It's a very paternalist attitude in a way, but it's not an unkindly paternalism. It's a sense, I think, that as near as he could tell, some people are incapable of the kind of rational activity at even a minimal level, let alone activity at the level of virtue. Hence, in his judgment, the best social institution that could be imagined for this is an institution of natural slavery. I find myself in considerable disagreement with that, and I think that there's a very far different ways of handling people who are unable to make such good decisions for themselves without resorting to slavery. But this is what he says and why he says it. The balance of the politics is not about that, however. Right from the very beginning of the Politics, Book 1, Chapter 10, one sees Aristotle coming as close as he ever does in his texts to a notion of natural law. At one point, for instance, Chapter 13 of that first book, he talks about a common law according to nature that actually exists and that can be known by everyone. And he makes reference to that very text in Sophocles' Antigone with which I began this lecture series. He makes no particular use in the Politics of the notion of a higher law to criticize normal human legislation, but he does give us the tools for doing that, and many a natural law thinker will return to this early part of the Politics for some justification for the practice of judicial review. Rather, what he insists upon and makes his strongest contribution to the theory of natural law is by his insistence on a teleological ordering for all of our considerations of ethics and politics. To call it a teleological ordering is to emphasize that notion of final causality that I was discussing at some length in the last lecture, namely, his sense that there is a final cause already embedded in the nature of any given individual, and likewise he thinks that there is a final cause embedded in the state. Here, too, we have a difference from our modern notions that needs careful consideration. The ancients tended to think of individual human beings as parts of a social whole, and Aristotle is strong in that attitude. Hence, the goals of individuals are subsidiary to the goals of a state. And for Aristotle, as for Plato, the goals that we have in terms of virtuous activity, manifesting all of our powers, bringing them to the peak of excellence by developing steady habits, reliable dispositions so that we'll be prudent and courageous and temperate and just. All of those things, nice as they are, important as they are for individual flourishing, for him are less important than the good of the state, because the good of the state will ensure the good of its various citizens, will make possible a life in which they flourish, but that it has certain greater demands, it has certain greater importance than any individual does. For this reason, Aristotle articulates that notion, which has been frequent in the rest of the history of ethics, that individuals must be willing to sacrifice themselves for their states, working for the common defense and working for the common good, because the state itself is conceived on the model of an organism. Just as our organism, our bodily integrity is important, so too he thinks of cities and of states as being modeled on that organic analogy, modeled on that organic basis. Here you see a considerable difference with much of later political tradition. By the time we get, say, to John Locke in a later lecture, we'll see that his model of the human being is definitely the model of the individual, and that even the state has to be created by individuals for the sake of the individual good. Or in the balance of Christian history, one will see that tremendous devotion and importance accorded to the notion of person, and that person has an inestimable dignity, a human dignity that is unable ever to be violated so long as we are conducting ourselves morally. There will be a greater sense of the importance of the individual person later in history. With Aristotle, I think we see, rather, the individual exists for the sake of society, states have a nature like persons do, and that both politics and ethics should be handled on this model of the flourishing of nature, letting its end come to free and complete fruition. In the next lecture, we'll be considering the Stoics and their contribution to natural law.